So, yeah, you're recorded, so just know that. That means speak more, not less. The topic is allocation of scarce medical resources. And it's a topic which is relatively new on the scene, because historically neither cost nor scarcity was really much of an issue. The physician care tended to be more personal rather than communal or institutional. So basically, the doctor would go to this patient and focus on this patient's specific needs. Treatment was through relatively inexpensive, commonplace items. It wasn't as though you had treatments that took millions and millions of dollars to develop. And most diseases, frankly, either were healed or killed the patient or were deemed chronically untreatable. And that was it. You didn't have the whole process that we go through nowadays. I have a friend of mine, Ishtar Rafur Shlema, who was diagnosed 3 years ago with a horrible cancer that had started on the kidney and then it spread. And thank God, he's still around. He's gone through 4 or 5 experimental drugs where they try it on him. It works for a while, then it starts to go down, and then Baruch Hashem, they come up with something new to try on him. And I don't know how many millions of dollars have gone into that research that they're using that's saving his life. The issue of cost and scarcity is an issue now. Number one, we have the option of research investment, which creates a whole new level of cost. We have more expensive treatment options. We also have more extended treatment periods because of preventive medicine, because of our ability to mitigate problems over time. And so we have two questions that I'd like to address this evening. Number one, the question of my status as an individual versus somebody else's status as an individual. And number two, the issue of society versus the individual, spending a lot on one patient and consequently potentially harming other patients. The truth of the matter is that anyone who's ever dealt with medicine knows these questions are never cut and dry. If the doctor tells you it's that cut and dry, he's not telling you the truth. Meaning, I had a case, unfortunately, several years ago, as actually the same physician twice in a row, dealing with patients where he told the family, you should take this person off of life support because we need the bed for somebody else. And I had a friend who was the head of pediatrics, but also he was a key administrator in the ombudsman's office in the hospital. And he helped me to override what this physician was trying to do. It's not normal to have a situation where you can say cut and dry, it's this patient versus another one. But philosophically, this comes up as an issue, and it dictates the policies that we employ when it comes to treating patients. So first, let's talk about the issue of the status of individual versus individual. And the philosophical point that I want to show here is the issue of my responsibility towards others. The Bein Adam L'Chaveiro requirement that I aid other people is not some uber value that overrides and overshadows the rest of halacha, but rather it fits into a halachic structure. So that when you say, well, I have an obligation of chesed, I have an obligation of tzedakah, therefore I should be willing to suspend my own rights on behalf of somebody else, the answer is lav davka, not necessarily. There's a halachic structure that will dictate when I'm supposed to do that and when I'm not supposed to do it. And the source for this is a very well-known gemara. And it's source number one. It's a gemara in Bava Metzia. I only did the English translations for this. If you want the Hebrew at some point, I'd be glad to provide it for you. You can look it up. But I decided to err on the side of providing the English. The gemara in Bava Metzia. If two people were traveling, one of them holding a pitcher of water, and the result of both drinking would be that they would both die. Right? You're familiar with this? This is a classic source. But if one would drink, then he would reach civilization. This is clearly a hypothetical case, because how do you ever know? Right? You can't imagine you have two people out in the wilderness and they actually know if we both drink, yeah, and if one of us drinks. But this is a hypothetical case, and it's important because of the principle that we can deduce from it. So Ben Petura taught, better for both to drink and die rather than for one to see the other one die. Share the water. Don't take the water for yourself, even though you know that this is going to lead to both of them passing away. Rabbi Akiva taught, it is written, the life of your brother will be with you, v'chei achicha imach. Your life precedes that of your brother. It's v'chei achicha imach. Your brother's life shall be with you. So in the absence of your life, if it's going to cost your life, you don't worry about your brother's life. That's the position of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva's stance is the one that we accept as halacha. Chayecha kodmin, your life comes first, overriding the opinion of Ben Petura. And that shows that my responsibility towards others is not the be all and end all. So far, so good. I once taught this source in a class, and a woman pointed out to me that she can't see in practice ever doing this. In other words, imagine that you're actually in such a situation. She can't imagine that she would just drink and watch the other person die of thirst. That's true.
But it's a problem. It's the error of the child.
Yeah, I mean, these are the cases that we're familiar with, unfortunately, from the Holocaust. They haven't always been hypothetical questions in our history. But the principle they're trying to teach us here is your life is supposed to precede that of any others. My relationship with Hashem, who created me and told me, be here on earth, is supposed to be what comes before anything else. And that principle is taken as a given in a Gemara in Nedarim. This Gemara is a little bit less well known. Source number 2. If a spring is owned by a certain town, and there is a choice between their lives, meaning their access to the spring, they're going to use it for their own water, and the lives of others, their lives come before those of others. Right? Meaning, we've got the spring, we're going to be able to use it to get drinking water, everybody else down there is going to not have sufficient drinking water, all the health problems that come with that, not just dying of thirst, but all the health problems that come with insufficient water supply, too bad. Our life comes first. Their animals, the animals of that town, precede the animals of others, and if there is a choice between their laundry and that of others, their laundry comes before that of others. If there is a choice between the lives of others and their laundry, I want to divert the water to do laundry, and the people downstream, as a result, are not going to be able to drink. The lives of others precede their laundry. Fine, that one mocha. You can have the drinking water. But Rabbi Yosef says, no. He says, your obligation is to yourself. Their laundry precedes the lives of others. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein discusses this case and suggests that this is actually not a pikuach nefesh discussion. He can't believe Rabbi Yossi would actually have said, do your laundry at the expense of somebody else's life. But that's sure what it sounds like from this Gemara. But the Gemara takes it as a given that we follow Rabbi Akiva, right? And that we reject the view of Ben Petura. Rabbi Moshe also, in that tshuva, provides a very interesting framework for understanding this machlokas. What exactly is the debate about here? He suggests that Ben Petura argues that I have two obligations. One, pikuach nefesh, and two, tzedakah. So when it comes to my own life, all I have is the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. When it comes to somebody else, I have pikuach nefesh plus tzedakah. So therefore, it's 2 versus 1. And therefore, I should give to the other fellow to make sure that he has something to drink too. Granted that it's going to end up being inadequate, but that's Ben Petura's suggestion. Whereas Rabbi Akiva says, no, this is an important principle in tzedakah. Rabbi Akiva says, there's no chiyuv of tzedakah. There's no obligation of giving tzedakah if I am lacking that which the pauper is lacking. That which my intended recipient is lacking. Just like the Gemara talks about Hashavas Aveda, returning a lost object. What happens if there's a river that floods my field and it pulls something downstream and I see my object going into the river and somebody else's object as well? My obligation is to take care of my object, not take care of his object. It's an extension of Chayecha Kodmin. But the idea is that in general, when it comes to Chesed, I don't have to provide for somebody else that which I lack myself. That's Rav Moshe's principle.
It's hard to
hard to, when you think about the consequences of the first Gemara, so it's hard really to compare them even. It sounds like they're comparable, but they're not. Sure. Look at Venta Torah. Rather than for one to see the other die. So it means one is going to die, and in effect one is not going to die, so then he's going to have to live with the guilt. So he's worried, in effect, about what potentially could happen after. Not so much that they're both going to die clearly, because of course there's human factors. Also the fact that Ben Torah is, if not aware of, subconsciously aware of. So, okay, so now I'm going to have to live with the fact that, you know, oh, I took all this water away and I could have shared it, so I did it this way. So now I'll live better when I finally do make it. I'm going to live better. The second one is simply, no. You're allowed to feel that you can somehow, you can justify worrying about yourself. Like, they're not so comparable. Like, I have trouble just saying, yeah, like, when you read it for the first time, okay, it looks like it. But I'm not so sure about it now.
I'm not sure I understand why there's a difference, though. Meaning, Rabbi Akiva's stance is the one that's really the comparable one. It's not Ben Petura's stance. The Rabbi Akiva's position is the one that says, your life precedes that of your brother, which Nedarim is taking as well.
Right.
Ben Petura, yeah, it could be that Ben Petura is taking into consideration this impossibility of a person living with himself knowing he did this, if that's what you're reading into, you know, seeing the other one die.
Rather than for one to see the other die. I guess, okay, so in those couple minutes that you're supposed to, technically they could die at the same time, which is probably impossible. So then you even for those couple of minutes or hours or whatever, you don't want to live with that kind of guilt. So he wants to free you from that. And if you share it, you know, I don't know what he means.
Like, for one to see the other one die would be if I would drink and not give to the other fellow. And then I survive.
No, because even if you share it, you're going to die.
Right, but he's okay with that. He says better for both to drink and die, right?
Right.
Better for both of them to drink and die, and one is going to go before the other, presumably that's true. Rather than for one to drink all of it and see the other one by knowing he's going to survive him personally.
Uh-huh.
I believe that's Ben Petura's statement.
I
think that's Ben Petura's statement. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So the so Rabbi Akiva, as Rabbi Moshe understands it, is saying that there's no mitzvah of tzedakah at all. That's a very interesting discussion in and of itself. What Rabbi Moshe is raising, this issue of my chiyuv tzedakah, and where is my obligation? The Shulchan Aruch says that everybody, every Jew is obligated to give some tzedakah. He says even the pauper has to give a third of a shekel a year, half a shekel a year. Everyone has to give something. But I don't have to give somebody what I don't have. And the reason that's particularly fascinating to me is because we know that the mitzvah of tzedakah is more than just the classic 10% that people say. 10% is not the mitzvah of tzedakah at all. 10% is a nice minhag that we call Meiser Ksafim. Some call it a Derabbanan. It's based on the Pasuk of Aser to Aser. But the mitzvah of tzedakah is lahachayosa, to keep people alive, and more than that, to keep people alive in the standard to which they are accustomed. So that if I know somebody who came down from having been very wealthy, now, you know, now he no longer has two limousines, he has one now, Nebuch, I'm supposed to supply him with a second limousine. Now, there's a whole separate discussion about allocation of tzedakah money, but if I'm a guy who doesn't even have one limousine, then I don't have a responsibility to take it to that level, according to what Ramosha is telling me. If I don't have it, I don't have to provide it for somebody else. That's what Ramosha is framing here as the logic of Rabbi Akiva. So what we've shown is that me as an individual versus you as an individual, I come first. But when you extrapolate from there to society, it becomes more complicated. The society is not a clear-cut entity. Meaning, do I view society as a collection of individuals? Or do I view society as an entity with its own obligations and rights as a corporation, so to speak? How do I look at society? Social responsibility fills the Torah's narrative in general, right? You think of the before the Mabul, right? Mal'ah ha'aretz Hamas mipneihem. Hamas has various translations, but basically it all boils down to taking something by force from somebody else. All of the standard explanations for Hamas revolve around that idea. And Hashem says, I created this world and told you, Pruvu mil'ues ha'aretz, I told you to fill the earth. I am going to roll back creation because it's not going the way I wanted it to. And if you look in the Psukim by the Mabul, you find Hashem literally rolls back creation. It describes the rolling back of day 6 and day 5 and day 4 and day 3 and so on. Hashem says, it didn't work out. I'm going to have to try again. I'm working against my own agenda because the world is now filled with Hamas, with people taking things by force. You're responsible to each other. You're responsible not to take from each other. Put it in the positive. We find numerous examples throughout the Torah of people being responsible for society. Whether it's Abraham negotiating on behalf of the city of Sodom, whether it's Yaakov before the incident with Dinah setting things up for the city of Shechem. The Gemara explains that Yaakov, when he camps outside of Shechem, actually prepares a currency for them. He does various things on behalf of the city. Whether you talk about Abraham and Sarah and Achnasas Orchim, we find the idea of responsibility towards others, and we find the idea of responsibility towards community. Take a look at source number 3, the classic Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Right? Ha'omer shali shali v'shalcha shalcha, the trade of, right? Someone says, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. That trait is that of the city of Sodom. Right? It's the trait of the city of Sodom. What does that mean when you say what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours is the trait of Sodom? What does that mean in that Mishnah? We've learned that Mishnah so many times. Right? What does it actually mean? Why is what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours such a horrible thing? You're going to call it the trait of Sodom? You know the other view in that Mishnah says, Zomi de Benonis, that it's an intermediate trait. So either it's intermediate or it's Sodom. Take your pick. What is so horrible about saying what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours?
I think it's horrible.
Yeah, most people wouldn't think it's horrible. That's the way society functions, right? The problem is it draws a line. It draws a line of mine and yours. You know? Sorry?
That was Sodom. Everyone spoke their own language. Everyone did their own thing. And they never met, right?
Yes, in Sodom, no one is...
She wanted to borrow. Wife wanted to borrow something. So
right.
A salsa, right. You know. So that was the problem. That even something simple, when you say something like that, when it gets to be, okay, emergency situations are one thing, but just kind of everyday situations become impossible. It is impossible to live like that. That's so simplistically, like you said, configured that everything's divided.
Right.
It's just too hard on a very, very everyday, simple level.
Right. And ultimately, what it leads to is hostility. If I come to you and say, can I have a little salt? Right? Or if, you know, you move in next door and the first thing that you do is mark out your boundary and make sure that, you know, nothing of mine is an inch over, and you call me up the first day that a weed spreads and say, hey, well, not anymore here. Now I understand that the weeds are everywhere. But if you're going to have that kind of hakpada, that you're so careful about everything, that creates tremendous animosity. Now, they tell the story of the grub. The Gra used to get called in Vilna every time they wanted to have a town meeting and a discussion or whatever. They would call in the Gra, and the Gra finally got fed up with it. And he said, you know what, listen, if you have something new to discuss, then bring me in. If it's the same old thing, I'm not interested. So they call him up one day, they're having a terrible problem with Mishulachim. People are coming in, they want to collect, and it's too much. So the town council says, we're going to make a gezera in the town that... We only keep our money local. We don't give our money out outside of local needs. It's only going to go for local needs. And they call in the Gra, and the Gra says, what's up? And they tell him what's up, and he says, didn't I tell you to only call me in for things that are new? And they said, well, this is new. He said, no, it's not. That's Sodom. That's Sodom. We don't help anybody who's an outsider. We only help our own. And it's a problem nowadays because we're dealing with exactly that problem. I mean, I had a benevolent fund I was responsible for in Allentown. In the last couple of years, I've really had so much local need to fill that I had to turn away people for who I liked to help in the past from outside. And I had to say to them, this is local. I felt terrible. But unfortunately, you do have to balance out.
As long as you feel bad.
That's true.
No, as long as you feel bad. Because here they're not saying, and they felt bad.
Right, this is my meat.
In Sodom, right, the midrash is that they made everybody fit into the beds.
Right.
Everybody has to fit. If you're too long, you have to be shortened. If you're too short, you have to be lengthened. So that no one could have individuality. Right. You can't have an individuality out of this. You have a set. You have your place. And think about it. You can't even expand. You can't develop. You can't work out something that will share this and this. Because I want, and you can't borrow.
Right.
Of course you can't borrow. Because borrowing and lending, money lending, is essential for society. People
right.
Get it. And if you don't have it, you don't have any growth at all. So you don't have any growth. You know, you're not going to...
Right.
So as long as you feel bad.
Thank you. So we find social responsibility all over the Torah. And the idea that you don't draw lines and you're willing to give. It comes up in a beautiful quote in the Kuzari, which really doesn't have that much to do with the Shir, but I love the quote in source number 4. Where the Kuzari said, he's talking about Tefillah B'Tzibur, davening with others. He says, among the benefits of a community is this. A community doesn't daven for the harm of an individual. But an individual might daven for that which will harm other individuals. Right? The classic story in the Gemara with... not Rav Chanina ben Dosa, but it's one of the Tanoim, I'm blanking now on which one, he goes out on the road, and it's raining. And so he davens, and he says, look, Hashem, the whole world is happy, but Chanina, I think it is Chanina, ben Tzahar, he says, I'm in pain. So Hashem stops the rain. And then he gets to his destination, and he says, yeah, I'm happy, but everybody else is in pain, and the rain starts again. So when you're a Chanina ben Dosa, you can do that. But he says a community, an individual might pray for that which will harm other individuals. It is even possible that there may be among the individuals who make up the community, some will pray for that which harms themselves. In other words, when you daven b'tzibur, when you have the community together, the community is not going to try to hurt an individual. And people within the community will even look past their own personal agenda, we hope, in order to daven for the sake of the community, knowing that it hurts them, knowing that they are not going to benefit. Warren Buffett says that that as an investor, you should always want stocks to go down until the day you're ready to sell. Then they should spike.
Right.
Right. So you should daven for the market to tank as long as you have money to buy stocks. Right. That's what you should do. But that's terrible because everybody else is going to suffer because maybe they need to sell now. See, we try to think as a tzibur. That's the idea. We try to think of ourselves as a tzibur in tefillah. We try to think of ourselves as a tzibur in terms of our chesed obligations. It comes up in business ethics as well. There's a major machlokas between Milton Friedman and Chaim Soloveitchik on not person to person across the table, but there's a major machlokas on how we view a corporation. It's very interesting. Milton Friedman said that a corporation owes debt only to its owners. And a corporation should not be involved in social needs, other than to the extent that it will serve, ultimately, its shareholders. But other than that, the corporation is not like an individual. An individual has obligations to others, society or a corporation does not. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik disagreed. He says obligations are corporate as well. And he said, look at Tzedakah. Tzedakah appears twice in the Torah. Parshas Re'eh and Parshas Behar. In Behar, it speaks to the individual. The language is Lashon Yachid. Kiyamuch Achicha. Right? When your brother becomes needy. However, in Re'eh, it talks about an Evyon in the community. Right? B'ircha, B'artzucha, that whole line there. It's about communal. So that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik argued that the obligation is not just an individual obligation, but it's a communal obligation of tzedakah as well. And that has all sorts of ramifications in business ethics in terms of a corporation. Does a corporation have a responsibility to the community in terms of causing harm, not causing harm, in terms of giving tzedakah, being involved in charitable endeavors? We could easily give an entire business ethics class on that right now, but Rabbi Berzon is coming in 9:15 for his shiur, so I want to. I just suffered to mention it because I like the topic. What we've established is if you follow the view of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, then regarding business matters, the corporation does have an obligation, the community does have an obligation. We see it certainly when it comes to tzedakah. We see it when it comes to tefillah. There's a notion that community has um, a, a special status to it, which is obligated to, in that it is obligated to help others the same way that an individual is. So let's take this back to the medical resources issue, which we started with. That would seem to indicate that a community has an obligation to spend its assets, to spend its resources, even if it's going to be on helping an individual. The community has an obligation for the individual, but it's not so clear-cut. It's not clear-cut one way or the other. And here we need to go back to another classic Gemara. You can say something?
No.
Okay. Here we go back to a classic Gemara. It's Yerushalmi source number 5, with the story of Sheva ben Bichri. Remember the story of Sheva ben Bichri, the rebel? He is liable for death as a Mori Malchus. He runs away into a town, and the town is surrounded, and they say, listen, if you don't let him out, if you don't send him out, we're going to kill everybody in the town. That's the story, that's the story that the Gemara is about to invoke. We learned. Source number 5. If groups of people were traveling on the road, and they encountered non-Jews, who said, give us one of yours, and we will kill him. And if you don't, then we will kill all of you. Okay? Give us one of yours, and we'll kill him, otherwise we kill everybody. They didn't mention a specific person, they just said, we want one carbon. Then even if all would be killed, they should not give over anyone. They don't have the right to choose somebody. If the non-Jews specified a victim, such as Sheva ben Bichri, like that case, it's not involving non-Jews in that case, the point is only that one victim is being specified, then the group should give him over and not be killed. Is that clear? They specified somebody, hand them over. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, only if the victim is liable for death, like Sheva ben Bichri. He says, no. In Sheva ben Bichri's case, he was liable for death. That's why they handed him over. But ordinarily, we don't do that. And Rabbi Yochanan disagreed. He comes back to the initial view. He says, no, even if he is not liable for death, like Sheva ben Bichri, nonetheless, we would hand him over. What does this indicate about the group versus the individual? If you take the view of Rabbi Yochanan, even if he's not liable for death, we still hand him over. Who's more important, the group or the individual? Sorry? The group. You sure? Yeah, but think about it carefully. There's one more level here. I see one thing that makes me think so. They're all being killed anyway. That's what I'm saying. In other words, he's a dead man anyway. In our Sheva ben Bichri case, criminal or not criminal, they're going to wipe out the entire city.
If you hand over the criminal,
right.
They all live.
Right. But in other words, if they don't hand over Sheva ben Bichri, the whole town, including Sheva ben Bichri, is dead.
Right.
If they do hand him over, Sheva ben Bichri is dead. Everybody else survives.
Right.
So by giving him over, we're not really saying we choose the benefit of the group over the individual, because he was dead either way.
But the group lives.
Right.
And
that's true.
The power of the group.
But you're not, he's not suffering for the sake of the group. He was going to die anyway. Take it to the case of Abraham and Sarah coming to Mitzrayim, right? The Abraham and Sarah are going down to Mitzrayim. Abraham says to Sarah, listen, tell them you're my sister, right? So people often think of that story and say, boy, is that terrible? Abraham is turning Sarah over to Paro in order to help himself, so that I should be okay. But he's not, because the assumption that he and Sarah make is that Sarah's going to Paro regardless. The only question is whether it's over Abraham's dead body or not. Right, that's the assumption that they make, right or wrong, separate discussion. But Abram and Sarah think that these metropolitan Egyptians with their city ways are going to attack Sarah regardless. That's what's going on in the Sheva ben Bichri story. Sheva ben Bichri is a dead man anyway. The only question is whether he's going to take the town with him.
I think that's the significant part.
But it's
if that one person dies either way.
Right.
Or one person, the same person would die either way. But in one case, hundreds of thousands die. In the other case, one dies.
Right. But it's not because we're not harming him to save everybody, because he was dying anyway.
I'm not suggesting you are. more harmful.
Okay, then we're on the same page.
Yeah, I think it's just more powerful to be able to save the group, and I think that gives the group the power. Mm-hmm. That one individual, because he's named, it's not that he's just randomly chosen. He's named, and I think the significance is that he's named.
Got it. And clearly we do distinguish between the naming and the not, and that does support the, it's the non-naming case that actually supports your view, I think. It's the fact that in the case where he's not named, even though, again, he's going to die anyway, that we're not able to act. There's a more clear-cut case, though, and it's the Gemara in Gittin, source number 6 and 7. The Mishnah in Gittin deals with a horrible case of how to deal with ransoming captives. The Mishnah says one may not redeem captives for more than their value. We assume that value means as they would be sold on the slave market. That's what we're talking about. So the Romans had a particularly nasty habit of kidnapping people and selling them as slaves. And you can pay, you can buy them out, essentially. That you can do, but you can't pay more than their value. Why? The Mishnah says, "Mnei tikkun ha'olam." For the repair of the world. That's what that's your justification for not doing more than their value. Why is that tikkun ha'olam? Why is that repairing the world? The Gemara is source number 7. The Gemara suggests two different explanations. One, well, does tikkun ha'olam refer to the burden upon the community or to a concern that the captors may capture and bring more captives? Meaning, there are two different ways to look at this tikkun ha'olam rationale. Number one is to say it will be a burden upon the community. Meaning, let's say going rate for a slave, I'm making up numbers, let's say going rate for a slave is $5,000 and they want 10. So the reason why we are not supposed to do more than $5,000 is because we're going to go out fundraising. Who can say no? Right? We tell people this person can be sold as a slave. We're raising $10,000. You have to give. That's one explanation for tikkun ha'olam. Don't pay more, because if you do, you place a burden on the community. The other approach is don't pay more because it's an incentive for them to go out and get more. Right? Look at terrorists nowadays. I mean, this is a known issue. It's not a mystery to anybody. The more you're willing to hand over, the greater the incentive for them to do it all over again. So the Gemara wants to know, which one is our rationale? What is our reason for what do we mean when we say tikkun ha'olam? So the Gemara says, Tashma, come in here. Levi bar Darga redeemed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinar. An important principle to know from the Tosfos and Bava Basra, when you see in the Gemara the number 12,000 or 13,000, it means a really large number. It doesn't mean 13,000 per se. The 12,998, 13,000, now she's redeemed. That's not what it's talking about. But he pays a massively large sum, clearly more than someone is going for on the slave market. So Levi bar Darga did it. So that would seem to indicate that our concern is burden upon the community, right? If the concern is burden upon the community, I am entitled to spend my personal fortune on redeeming somebody no matter how much I pay. However, if the operative issue is that the captors are going to come and take more captives, I don't have the right to spend my personal fortune. Even though I'm spending my personal fortune on this one, it still gives them the incentive to do this all over again, right? You see what I'm saying? So Levi bar Darga seems to prove that the issue really is the former. The issue is the burden upon the community. That's really what it's about. Abaye, however, says, don't prove anything from Levi bar Darga, who says the sages agreed with this. Perhaps he did it against the desire of the sages, right? Levi bar Darga is a wealthy man. He has the money to redeem his daughter from captivity. You think the Chachamim getting up and saying he shouldn't do this is going to stop him? Of course not. He's going to go redeem his daughter. So Abaye says that's not an adequate proof. So what do we hold? In practice, what do we actually do in such a case? What if I want to redeem myself? What if I want to redeem a relative? So the Tosfos in Gittin presents each view in trying to justify a Gemara from later in Gittin. The Gemara later on in Gittin, it's the classic Tisha B'Av Gemara, talks about Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya was a fascinating Tana. He's a sage in the time of the Mishnah, who makes it a habit of visiting the Romans. And in general, he engages in debates with them, he talks with their aristocrats. So he is taking a tour of the Roman prisons, and he hears that there's a beautiful Jewish kid there in the prison. And he's a Talmud Chacham, and there's a whole thing in the Gemara about it. He quizzes him, and Rabbi Yeshua Chanan is very impressed. And he says, source number 8, I will not budge from here until I redeem him for whatever sum they demand. No matter what they ask, I am willing to pay it. And that's what he does, and the kid grows up to be Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. There are 3 Rabbi Shmuel ben Elishas in the Gemara, but this is one of them, and he becomes a tremendous Tana. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya says, I'm going to redeem him for all the money. So Tosfos asks, does that then show that we're not concerned? So Tosfos suggests a couple of rationales. He says, maybe this was a case in which Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha would have been killed there in the jail. So it's pikuach nefesh. He's saving a life, that's a different story. That's one explanation. Another explanation may be because he could tell Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha was going to grow up to be a big Talmid Chacham, so it's a communal need, and therefore we'll pay whatever is necessary. That will be a second potential explanation. Those are both possible explanations. The Rambam on this tries to give us a psak to explain what we do. Source number 9 in Hechaz Matnos Aniyim, the laws of tzedakah. Source number 9. He says one may not redeem captives for more than their value, due to tikkun olam, like we said, lest the enemies pursue them to capture them. In other words, lest we give them an incentive. Right? That's the Rambam's ruling.
How are they getting this term? Like, tikkun olam today is... You don't always take it back to this technical term. How are they getting... Really, how are they originating the term tikkun olam to... Either one of these, either burdening the community or taking captives, which in the end is the same thing, but either one of them really.
Right.
How are they developing this term?
Good question. The Tikkun Olam, in its original context, is a term used in a series of Mishnayos in Gittin. And that's where this comes into play. The Mishnah there in Gittin is a whole parak of things that are Mipnei Tikkun Olam. And the Gemara adds more cases, like visiting people who are sick, even if they're not Jewish, and all that. It's a whole series of cases. But basically, it seems to be practices that we are supposed to do, or things we are not supposed to avoid doing, in order to benefit society. That's the essential term. But yeah, it does get thrown around kind of a lot.
No, but I forgot. There's a whole bunch of other lists of things, and this is just one more example of, you know, our approach to tikkun olam, which is an interesting approach when you think, you know, olam. Like, what olam are you talking about? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You bet. So the Rambam says that society has to come first. That's essentially what he's ruling, right? He's saying we don't pay extra to redeem captives for more than their value, lest the enemies go after people and then start capturing others. So that the society has to come first. The Shulchan Aruch. Hey, come on in. The Shulchan Aruch, on the other hand, says the following. Take a look at source number 10. He says, one may not redeem captives for more than their value due to tikkun ha'olam. We got a late start. One may not redeem captives for more than their value due to tikkun ha'olam, lest the enemies endeavor to capture them. Right? So far, it's just like the Rambam. Right? So far, so good? Okay? It's verbatim. But one may redeem himself for any sum he chooses. But I can pay whatever I want when it's me. I can put myself then over the needs of others. The same is for a Torah scholar, like the Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha case, or even one who is not a Torah scholar but is a sharp student and may become a great man. One redeems him, because really, you don't know Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha is going to become Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. His mother didn't call him Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. One redeems him for a great amount of money. So the Shulchan Aruch's codification of this is really mixed. It's society over individual, in that we don't want to bankrupt the community, right? And in the exception that he gives of the Talmud Chacham, because the Talmud Chacham will benefit society. But it's individual over society, because he says you're allowed to redeem yourself for any sum you choose. He's coming down on both sides of the fence. So let me translate this back now to the issue of communal access to medical resources. We seem to place society ahead of the individual in general. We say that society is a separate entity, potentially with its own obligations, like we said from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. But in general, I have an obligation to daven for others, I have an obligation of tzedakah for others, we avoid midas and sedom. So we say that, yes, individual is supposed to serve society, not though at the cost of his own life. Right? My obligation of tzedakah for others, or Moshe's thing. So it sounds like I should not appeal for personal care at the expense of the community if it will drain the community's ability to take care of itself. That's the upshot. If I am going to drain the community of its ability to help the community as a whole, and it's not coming out of my pocket, then I'm like the fellow who wants to be ransomed at the community's expense. And I don't have the right to make that demand on the community. The problem with everything we've said is that it's all theory. Just like the case we started with Rabbi Akiva and Ben Petura. Because you never really know. You don't know that the money that we're putting into this specific disease, which only affects 5 people, is going to be money that could otherwise have gone for a disease that afflicts 5 million people. We don't know that at all. We don't know how long it's going to take to find a cure. We don't know how what you find when you're researching this disease might help cure some other disease. Everything overlaps. It's much more complex. Even in the hospital situation, which is a much more controlled environment, we're not dealing with research now, it's a much more controlled environment. I have one patient here and I have 5 patients there, whatever it is. I still don't know. It's very hard for me to gauge because I don't know what I take away from one. Will it really help the other? It's not clear cut. So my goal here is not to really provide, this is our answer, and I don't think anybody really expected that. If you did, I'm sorry. But rather to review the issues that are involved. So one more time, we talked about just historically how this is a relatively new issue. We pointed out the issue of me as an individual versus somebody else as an individual and how my life comes first. And we gave Ramosha's explanation of why that should be so. We talked about society versus the individual and the philosophical point of viewing society as more than a collection of individuals, as an entity with its own needs and its own responsibilities. And then lastly, the question of, so does society have automatic overriding status? It sounds like the answer is yes, unless you are helping yourself. It sounds like I can't demand more from society for myself, but I can demand. I can choose to use my own resources however I choose. That's in a nutshell. I hope that it was clear. I rushed a little bit because we got that late start. I'm sorry about that. God willing, we'll do another topic next week. I hadn't picked one. What do you think of cosmetic surgery as a topic? Doesn't do anything? Yes? No? Maybe?
Sounds interesting.
I'll tell you what. It's a shear for women, but it applies to men also. My email address is torchiner@gmail.com. The torchiner is TORCZYNER. So if you come up with any thoughts about what you'd like to have for the topic next.